if you ever promised yourself. This is finally the time. You're going to save more, invest, finally get organized, and then it just falls apart. It's time to figure out the psychology that separates those who successfully smash their goals from those who try for a while, then fall off the wagon. And Dom Vertice is the guy who can help you figure that one out, because he specializes in taking people from pretty good to world-class success. He's a psychologist who's worked in the ultimate high-pressure situations, guiding Olympic athletes, New Zealand rugby, the All Whites, people who have to get their head right when the entire world is watching.
The best athletes, they are not scared of those pressure situations. In fact, they invite it in. This is why when I talk about performance under pressure, I don't like that term. I like to talk about embracing pressure, because you've got to move towards it. There's a difference between distress and eustress. Distress is things that are really unhelpful. Eustress is good stress for you, like planning a wedding.
This same psychology that helps someone perform under stadium lights is the same psychology behind whether you stick to a savings plan, follow an investing strategy, or finally break that cycle of, I'll start again next month. Same patterns, same pressure points, the same self-sabotage.
The number one skill or tool is learning where to place your attention at any particular time, because there is so much noise going on in the world that our minds get cluttered, emotion takes over, and if we can bring ourselves back to the present moment, that is the number one skill.
So today, we're going inside the mind of high performers and translating what actually works there and into our money lives. Welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And after today, you're going to be in control of your mental habits rather than your mental habits taking control of you. So let's go. Dom Vertice, welcome to Making Sense. So you are registered clinical and performance psychologist. You've worked with, correct me if I get any of this wrong, the All Whites, New Zealand Rugby, the New Zealand Olympic Committee. What an interesting career. How do you even get into this? Didn't know it was an option.
I probably didn't know it was an option when I first started psychology. I was more interested in forensics and corrections and people in prison, to be honest. And
quite different.
Very different. So when I went through my training, that's where I originally started, was about 4 years in corrections and a year in forensics, and really enjoyed that. And it was a supervisor of mine that said to me, hey, look, you love your sport. My husband's a sports psychologist. You should go and talk to him. So that's what I did.
Amazing. How do you find it dealing with, I mean, obviously now, especially working with the Olympic Committee, you must be working with some people at the absolute peak of their game. Are there sort of challenges with that? Are these quite highly strung people, or are they people who are just really focused? You know, what sort of personality types do you find yourself working with?
Certainly, I wouldn't say they're highly strung at all. I actually love working with them. Our Kiwi athletes are so down to earth. They're so authentic. They're incredibly lovely, but extremely driven. And I really like that balance. I think it fits quite well with my personality, whereas I think I'd find it a little bit more challenging if we did have some of what we call the stereotypical highly strung athletes, which I haven't run into very many at all in New Zealand. So I feel very lucky and blessed.
What sort of things do you find? What sort of common issues can crop up when you are dealing with people who are so focused and so goal-driven on it's a very measured goal. You kind of, you win or you don't. And for these very driven people, that must be interesting.
One of the most common ones is around perfectionism and having to get things right all the time. You're constantly being evaluated, whether that be within your training, whether it be in your gym, whether it be your nutrition, whether it be selection. So there's a lot of challenges around that, especially when it's closer to a pinnacle event. But the other stuff a lot of our psychologists end up working with is generally their lives, their relationships, and things that go on outside of the work on the field. And certainly when you get to kind of the elite pinnacle level, you got to remember, as well as your position as a psych, they've already got there a lot of the time themselves without a bunch of support. So sometimes you're just really trying to maintain that for them and being an outlet for them that they can speak to. And then there's the times where actually you've got to help shift them into a place where they need to constantly find their edge. And how do you do that in a really safe way that maintain their well-being and their integrity throughout their process. Because sometimes that's the part that in high-performance sport we can forget is when they're trying to find the edge, how do we make sure that doesn't come at a cost to their mental health or their well-being as well?
Talk to me a bit about finding that edge for people and that balance, because I've seen a sort of sentiment around that if you want to be someone who achieves really highly, you're going to have to sacrifice things that a lot of people aren't prepared to sacrifice. And that it like you said, there's going to be a cost. It might be quite a high cost. Do you think that necessarily has to be the case? Like, can you balance being very high achieving in a very specific way with still being mentally healthy? Is that possible?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. It sometimes can differ depending on the sport and the setup. So I think it's definitely possible here in New Zealand. I think it's a lot more challenging for our international athletes that play and perform regularly overseas. But yeah, like we see, especially here at High Performance Sport, people have a pretty good balance around like making sure they've still got their university studies that they're doing, or they're doing apprenticeships, or they'll have, you know, half a day off where they can do some professional development. I think the way that psychology works in New Zealand around high performance is making sure that they are a holistic person, even though they're still trying to perform. And we typically find that the people who are more holistic, understand more about themselves, will typically reach those heights and find the edge a lot more. In New Zealand as well, I think we do a great job of having psychologists in a proactive space. So you don't grab a psychologist or use a psychologist because you all of a sudden become mentally unwell. You're normally attached to one very close at the start of, you know, your career or at a time where things may be going well. So I'm a big believer in success leaves clues. And so, for example, if you're like noticing that you're doing really well, that's the perfect time to kind of understand what's going really well for you and then work on that with the psychologist. So yeah, I do think you can definitely get that balance, and it's becoming more and more prevalent now, where probably back old school days was about like, you have to, you know, be narcissistic, you have to trample on people in order to succeed. That's certainly not the case now.
Talk to me about that. Success leaves clues. How does that work, and how do you find those clues and build on them?
So I'm quite big on like reflection, journaling, review. So just trying to encourage people that you don't just learn from your mistakes, you learn from success. So the ability to ask yourself, what's going really well? Why is it going really well? When my attention, or when I performed here, my attention was in the right place. Well, how did you get to that point? When you performed well, what was your preparation like during your week? So it's just trying to find where are those clues. And over a period of time, if we can reflect on them, journal on them, you start to see patterns of behavior, patterns of thinking, patterns of emotion, patterns of things that are happening in their lives, and you want to build on that more and more consistently. And I think that starts to shift the dial, that again, using a psychologist when you're mentally unwell, and it's actually using a psychologist when you actually really want to be able to perform at your best for a long period of time. When you've got someone by your side doing that, as well as having and utilizing your coach, you can actually start to build up and figure out some of those patterns and build some decent, useful insight.
Yeah, it's really making me think of, I came across a saying very recently. It was literally like a week or so ago, and I still can't remember where I heard it now. But someone said, you can't read the label from inside the bottle, which I really loved. That just sort of reframed it for me, that no matter how good you are, no matter how well you've driven yourself until now, that outside perspective is going to be so needed in order to take you to the next level. Do you see that a bit?
Yes, definitely. Which comes in, like, the best athletes are willing to accept feedback. Same with the best coaches, they're willing to accept feedback. You know, it's that growth mindset. So if you're not willing to accept that, then it's very hard to make the progress. And it doesn't mean that you have to agree with it as well, but you need to be able to sit and marinate in it, think about it, and actually see where it makes sense in particular areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. I mean, recently I got some feedback that I didn't love. And it's funny because it was related to the business, and my husband works on this business with me, and he immediately started defending me, bless him, and being like, oh, well, I don't see other people having to do that. And, you know, and I was just like, babe, love you so much for like immediately jumping to my defense. Really appreciate that. But we're not getting defensive. We are taking the value of the feedback, and we're just going to let it soak in and see what we can learn from it. It's like, Okay, sort of like settled, defluffed. But I do think you can get feedback that you may or may not enjoy at various times. But it's incredibly valuable, sometimes even more so when it's feedback you don't enjoy, to be able to take that on board and be like, right, that sucks. What do I learn from that? Hard though, right?
Definitely. And sometimes it's a timing thing. When I was starting my master's, I wanted to go into sports psychology at that point in time. And I went to, I'll say another psychologist who was in sport, doing really well, and asked, like, how do I get into this? And he said, look, at the moment, there's not a huge amount of future in sports psychology in New Zealand. He was one of the top sports psychologists at the time. He's like, I've got two ice figure skaters. You're better to go off and do clinical psychology first, and then think about whether you want to come back into sport. But like that amount of feedback for me at that time felt like rejection, and it was hard to take. But now, reflecting back on what he was saying, he was absolutely right, because the training that I was able to receive has created a lot more depth in terms of my knowledge of understanding people, understanding systems, environment, and what's going to help people perform. It allows me to do some work in mental health within sport, which not necessarily all mental skills trainers or psychologists can actually do. Yeah. So sometimes that feedback might not be useful right then and there in the moment, but if we reflect on it and open our minds up enough later on, then sometimes that can be a really helpful space to be in.
100%. Okay. So when you are working with some of these people, are there psychological habits, tricks, systems that you help them put in place? And particularly, are there any that you think the average person could really benefit from as well?
The framework that I tend to use is a concept called understand me, be me, stay me. So understand me is about, I think that's probably the foundation of what psychology is know who you are as a human being, understand your identity, where you come from, your values, your strengths, your weaknesses, your vulnerabilities, your shadows, understand what that looks like and how that shapes your behaviors. Be me are the skills that are going to help you be the person that you understand yourself to be. So in psychology, we might talk about, you know, breath work, you might talk about meditation, challenging the way that you think, focus, a bunch of different things. Then on top of that is the stay me. So how do I stay myself under huge amounts of pressure or under stress? And so how are you maintaining that? What is your process? How are you testing that out? Now, the best high performance athletes work through that, not quite as sequentially as I like to. I'm a structured person, so I like the structure. But the best athletes, they are not scared of those pressure situations. In fact, they invite it in. This is why when I talk about performance under pressure, I don't like that term. I like to talk about embracing pressure, because you've got to move towards it. If I ask the question to most people, when you think about pressure or stress, what words immediately come to mind? And they will use often negative words. And if they're negative, we want to run away from it. The best athletes, the best performers are going towards it all the time. And so in the stay me, it's about testing those situations out so that when they come to that situation at Olympics, at a World Cup, at their pinnacle event, whether it's a surgeon in the surgery room, they know exactly what they want to do. Their brain's already computed everything that they need to do. They've visualized it and they're able to stay themselves in that amount of pressure.
It's really interesting flipping the, you're right. If you'd asked me to describe pressure situations, I probably would have gone negative framing as well. How do you start that process of flipping it to be positive or fuel or whatever flip you want to be putting on that?
Yep. So I would start with some like basic brain education about understanding what pressure does to the brain, where it are some helpful levels, some unhelpful levels. And then understanding what is their belief system around what pressure is. Like, what have they been taught about it? Most of the time we're taught that stress and pressure is a bad thing and that we don't want it in our lives. The unfortunate thing for high-performing athletes and probably like CEOs, and you're always under some sort of pressure or some sort of stress. But in fact, that can actually help your performances. So where have you seen that in your life where pressure or stress has actually helped you to be able to perform? There's a difference between distress and eustress. Distress is things that are really unhelpful. Eustress is good stress for you, like planning a wedding, for example. That's good stress that can happen. So it's just trying to understand what is your original belief system and how do we start to shift that.
I love that reframing, because I think, and obviously we're talking about some people at the real peak of how far they can push themselves. When we're talking about these athletes, I love watching a sports doco. I just find it fascinating. I'm by no means an athlete, not even close. But I just find it really fascinating, the situations they push themselves through and how they achieve through that. And I actually take so much from it for my own life. I mean, I think obviously very different things, but similar tactics, similar lessons often. And so I think about obviously people, you mentioned their CEOs, you know, high performing careers, even people who are running their own business, even if it's a small business, there might be a lot of pressure and you're maybe aiming for big things, a lot of pressure there. A lot of people might feel pressure just in their general financial situation. That's a very different type of one. A lot of people feeling the pinch these days. But even pressure when people start to get into investing and they feel stressed about making that work and getting into something new. So when you start to think about, you know, those tactics that you've used for those athletes and they're visualizing, they're working through it, they're trying to reframe that pressure. Can we take any of those pressure lessons for those more daily life pressures?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say the most pressure and stress I feel under is when I'm trying to be a dad.
Yes.
Oh, and I'm trying to be a good dad, whatever the heck that looks like. Because, man, having three kids running around always asking you questions, you start to notice yourself heat up and then you got to try to regulate your thing. So, like, if we think about performance, it can be performance, yes, as a high-performance athlete, as a CE, as a surgeon, but also just a performance as a husband, as a wife, performance as a father, performance as a family member, as a good friend. Like, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't really matter. What you're trying to do is be, I'm not sure I quite like this word, but being as authentic as you possibly can to your values, your authentic self in some ways, but you want that to line up. So any of those skills that we can talk about are really important and just you being you in any given moment in every day. So things like breath work and breathing skills to be able to regulate your emotions so that you can make good decisions. Because what's happening in the brain when you're stressed is there's a part of the brain called the amygdala that starts firing off. And it starts to shut down all of this part. And when you shut down this part here, your focus goes, your decision-making goes, it's harder to regulate your emotions. So having identity and understanding how that works, how that operates, what your triggers are, being able to breathe, some people meditate, visualize. There's a bunch of different things. The way that you talk to yourself in that particular moment, are you kind to yourself? Are you critical to yourself? Where does that come from? Those are things that we can use in our everyday life to try and be as true to ourselves as we possibly can.
It can sound, I think often we look for these big silver bullet solutions, but actually some of those tactics to just recenter yourself and be able to be like, right, hang on, how can I just get back to being calm and being able to think is so, so important. And you mentioned the parenting. How old are your kids?
I've got a 4-year-old, or she's 5 in 2 weeks. I've got a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Oh, mate, so like gorgeous ages. So mine is slightly out, also 4-year-old, and then an 18-month-old. So the 18-month-old, we certainly don't successfully do deep breathing together. He could do with some deep breathing, but we're still working on that strategy. But one of the things I am genuinely the most proud of as a parent is that when my 4-year-old is losing it, I'll sit him down and be like, I can't understand you when you're shouting at me. I need you to take some deep breaths with me. I want to hear what you're saying. I can only hear what you're saying when you stop shouting and crying. So we're going to take some deep breaths and then I'm going to listen to you. And he will actually do it now. He's old enough now. He does it. And we do some deep breaths together. And then I'm like, okay, what did dad do to upset you this time?
Oh, so you shift the blame.
Yeah! What did that schmuck do? Let me be the hero. Great parenting tactic. Yeah. But, you know, and he really does do it. And I hope that he keeps that tactic throughout his life, because that has been one of the most core things for me, is in all sorts of different situations, taking that moment to recenter, hang on, like get the brain out of panic mode and into calmly assessing the situation mode. It sounds so small. I actually think there's nothing more powerful. What about like for you? Is there... Obviously, that's a big tactic. Is there any others? Like, what would be your top three most powerful moments?
Us as adults, we've got to remember the foundation around your identity and what's really important to you and understanding who you are. And it's not necessarily that you have to have all the answers, but being on that journey, because the best athletes, the best performers, they anchor themselves in that, in those particular moments. And that allows them to zoom out, allows them to take that feedback. When we're more secure in who we are, we're more clear on our values, there's a lot of cool skill set that we can take from that. One of the core values that are really important to me is the concept of courage. And where I get that from is I found that my probably the person I looked up to the most was my grandfather. And he showed a huge amount of courage by bringing his family from England over to New Zealand, didn't know anyone, but the courage to kind of just go, this is going to be a better life for us. And so I've held on to that. And so whenever I'm struggling with something, I'll say one of the values that are really important to me is courage. What does courage look like in this particular moment? That doesn't necessarily, you know, you could say respect is something that is really important to me, or industry and working hard is important. What does industry or respect look like in this moment? Respect for the person I'm talking to, respect for my kids, respect for myself. What does that look like in the next action that I have? So I think identity is the foundation of all of the stuff that we're talking about, but knowing as one part, what is your value? Where does that come from? And how do you want to live that? I think the second thing is attention. So where do you put your focus when your emotions are going everywhere? And really, a lot of athletes will talk about control the controllables. So are you focusing on things that you can 100% control, or are you spending time focusing on what you can influence, or are you focusing on things that you cannot control? Because where the anxiety and stress and pressure comes in is when people put their attention on things that they cannot control. So it's learning ways to be able to train where do I put my attention, and good formal practice will be around meditation. But sometimes it even can just be creating a list of what's going on in my life, what is causing some stress or some anxiety, and put them down into columns. What are out of these are controllable? Well, I can do some of those things tomorrow. What are some things that I can only influence? Well, I spend less time focusing on those. And what are the things that I can't control? I don't really need to worry about those at the moment. So I think, yeah, anchor yourself in your identity, where you place your attention, and then probably even something around just what if scenarios. So if X happens, what does Y look like? How would I do that? You know, so start to strategically plan out what could go wrong, what could I do in that particular moment? Equally, don't want to be so deficit focused, but what could go right? And what would I do in those moments? And do I actually praise myself for those moments? Because I think Kiwis really struggle to praise themselves when things go well. I struggle with that significantly as well.
It's the flip side of a part of our culture that I love, where we are quite humble. We are very focused on, you know, not changing from who you were at the beginning. The flip side is you can also struggle to give yourself your flowers when you've earned them. And you've got to take the flowers, because otherwise, if you never enjoy the wins, it can really feel like a slog.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, for sure. There's a bunch of unhelpful thinking patterns that people will fall into. Two of the most common ones I find are mental filtering. So it's when you only filter in the things that have gone wrong in the day. So you're only paying attention to those things. So the idea, which is probably another skill set to have, is be able to reframe, be able to challenge the way that you are thinking. So it's then trying to find, well, what are some of the things that have gone well, or where I've learned? The other part to that is disqualifying the positive. So a lot of people will, even if they see something that is really positive, they'll say, oh, that was only just due to luck. Or an athlete might go, oh, we only won because they played really poorly. You know, so, and if you've got those two in balance, then it's real hard to be able to increase like our confidence or celebrate the wins or build up our self-esteem, our self-image as well. Yeah.
That's a really powerful point that I'm already thinking I might just like clip that bit of your interview and like send it to a couple of people I know. Because it does sound like a really hard way to live life, actually, frankly. Another thing I know people struggle with, right? And I imagine this is very similar for our financial lives and for sports people, because if you're getting into sports, you're not going to get in there, lift weights for a month, and you're going to the Olympics, right? It's a long journey. To get yourself into that peak performance, years of training, often from very young for these people, and you've got to keep going, eyes on the prize that whole time, really pushing yourself. And it can be very similar for people with their careers, with their finances. You might have a goal to buy a house. That can take years of saving. Or all sorts of other things. Some people want to hit financial independence, but the way they've planned it out, it's probably going to take them 10 years. So you can have these big goals that you know you want, and you know you want to hit it, you know it's going to be worth it. But when it takes years, I think it is so natural for motivation to fall along the way. So how do people stay focused on big goals and keep themselves going?
The thing that I think about, partly because I love food, is cake. And this is not mine.
I'm here for the cake analogy.
This is a friend of mine, so I'm going to steal his amazing work. But what he talks about is everybody in life typically wants the icing. You know, it makes a average tasting cake taste that little bit better. It makes a bad looking cake look even better. But the thing is that everyone's chasing the icing, chasing the sugar hit. They want the quick fix a lot of the time. And we tend to look at that as an outcome. And often a lot of the time, the outcome is hard to influence or it's uncontrollable. Like you can't necessarily always get the exact house that you want, right? Because there's other people that are trying to go for that particular house. So what we're trying to focus on is cake still tastes good even without the icing. So are we really clear on what your controllables are, on the things that you can actually focus in on? And normally that is around mindset, your values, your work ethic, and probably your preparation to a certain extent. So what has that started looking like? And so in sport, we talk about trust the process. And those are the things that are part of the process. And we break them down into smaller bits and pieces that are going day to day to day to day. So say, for example, you want to invest in something that is going to cost you $1 million. Well, sometimes $1 million is probably like so far out of our reach, right? But potentially saving $2 a day or $3 a day, that's not so bad. And how can I do that? How do I plan for that? If you attach that again to a value, if $3 a day means that I'm showing myself more respect, then we've got another layer of process that becomes more important to us that we're more likely to connect to. So when talking about the differences between sport or like investment or finances, I'd be going, yes, there's a big picture out there, but kind of what are my process goals? What are the things that are really important to me that I value that are actually broken down into smaller steps? Does that make some sense?
That makes so much sense.
So even for example, with football, we've got a World Cup coming up in 2026. We see those men four times a year to be able to get some decent amount of work done. So the majority of the time they're going back into their clubs. So what I try and get them to think about is what type of player and human being do you want to be by the time we get to the 2026 World Cup? That's the ultimate goal for them, is to be able to perform there. But then we've got to keep them motivated, even though we're seeing them five times a year, four times a year. So building a bit of a plan going backwards, well, what does that look like in 6 months' time? What does that look like in 4 months' time? What are you working on in terms of different areas of your life? And then what does that look like week to week? So we're breaking that down and they can slowly start to see that particular part of the process or progress, opposed to necessarily getting so and waiting for the World Cup to come. Yeah, so just it's just chunking. It's just breaking it down. I should have just said chunking and that would have saved probably about 5 minutes.
I liked it though. I like the examples. And when you chunk it like that as well, it's very similar to another phrase that I always remind myself of, you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, you know? And it's so easy to forget that. I really do try and remind myself of that saying a lot. But I also try to remind myself of like, I'll try and set in little on those chunks. This might be just because I love me a reward, but I'll have little milestones along the way and I'll attach a celebration to them of some kind. Now, obviously, with a lot of these goals being financial, I make sure my celebration is not ridiculous and going to derail it. The same way I'm sure a lot of your athletes probably don't try and celebrate by having a whole bunch of cake, even if they're thinking about the analogy of cake. But I try and build in little celebrations along those milestones too. Do you recommend that, or is that like a way to do things?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. So we want to reinforce good, positive behavior. I find in particular a lot of athletes, they just really want to learn. They want to grow and they want to learn. So even when they're doing their reflections, it's like, how do we add in like a growth element? Like, what have you learned today in your training? So I use an analogy called milk, which is, it's very cheesy, but milk with a K is strong for your bones. There's a lot of food and drink analogies in here. So milk with a K is strong for your bones and milk with a C is strong for your mind. And so M just means memory. What was your best memory from today? What was your best memory from how you saved, for example? I, improvement. Where did you improve? Even the smallest amount. So what did that look like over the last week in terms of your savings, your investments? L, what did you learn? Okay, so what did you learn about yourself, your teammates, your skill set? What did you learn about the way that you save? And C is courage. Again, coming back to my favorite value. Where did you show courage today in training? Where did you show courage over the last couple of weeks? Where did you show courage in the way that you decided to save when the mortgage rates, for example, went up? Did you decide in that particular moment to keep at the same rate, or did you drop it down because you were scared of what was going to happen? So you can even use like the reflection piece to be able to help build those rewards. Now you see that written down over a period of time. And in 2 months' time, you reflect back, look at all the stuff that I've learned. Look at all the areas that I've improved on. Look at where I've shown courage. That will start to build up that motivation. But when people don't record things, when they don't take notice of it, then we start to lose the motivation.
Yes, I'm absolutely going to steal that. We already do a little like sort of around the dinner table. You know, what was your favorite thing that happened today? As you say, you know, you don't want to get into that filtering only on the negative things that have happened. And that's really something we use in our household to try and, you know, remember the good things. Because I think it's very easy to lean into a negativity bias. But I'm going to steal that because I like that. So I think that's going to be expanding a little bit around the dinner table. When you mentioned about courage, I think that's really important because along the way, on a lot of the times as we are aiming for these big goals, we're trying to do more in life, we're trying to achieve things, you're also going to hit moments where you have to perform under pressure. Whether that's, you know, for an athlete, they're trying to qualify for an event or they're actually at the event and competing, or, you know, for the rest of us going for even just the job interview. For, you know, you haven't even got the job yet that you think, you know, you could perform under, but it'd be high pressure, but the job interview itself might be really high pressure. So as you're going through life and you're aiming for these big goals, but you hit moments along the way where also you have to perform under pressure, how do you help people get into the right mindset so that they perform instead of freeze?
I sometimes just come back to values again. And the reason why I like courage so much is there's one thing that you have to have in order to show courage, and that's fear. You have to have some level of fear in order to step into courage. So what it does is it normalizes what you are doing in high performance is probably not normal. You know, you have the fear of being making mistakes. You could have the fear of what you look like compared to other people. You have the fear of losing. You have the fear of status and being compared to other people. But what that does, the bigger the fear, allows you to step into courage. And the greater the fear, the greater the opportunity for courage. So what does courage look like in your next steps? So I would always try and go back to that to be able to help them get into the right mindset. I think as a psychologist, you've got to be very careful to not tell them what to do all the time, which can be very frustrating because people probably at times do come to me for advice. But if I can help them come to their own conclusions by asking questions that are insightful or useful, that's significantly more powerful. They feel more autonomy, more control over that. Because ultimately, when they're on the field, when they're on the pool, whatever it looks like, they need to be able to make decisions for themselves. And if I keep on telling them the answers all the time, then in that moment of pressure, they're not going to be able to make that decision for themselves. And it's the same as a parent, right? Like, so if we keep on making decisions for our kids and telling them exactly what to do, age and stage appropriate, right, then by the time they leave home at 18, they're not going to know what to do. They're not going to know how to make good decisions for themselves, whether it be about life, the way where they study, what their internship looks like, what their apprenticeship looks like, how they're going to spend their money. You know, so how are we kind of coaching that along the way becomes really important. So I guess going back to your question around how do I get them into the right mindset, they're getting into it themselves. I'm just helping them along the way. And I would often use their own values of what's really important to them to help shape the way that they see themselves and the way that they start to integrate their attitude into their behaviors or their performance.
It's almost like building that mental muscle as well of how to look at the problem and how to find their own solution. I often think, you know, my kid got really into puzzles recently, which was really fun, except he also gets really mad if he can't figure out a bit of it. And the way that I have to put my own hands behind my back to not help him, because like that's not actually helping him. He's weirdly enjoying the frustration. If I solve the puzzle for him, I've ruined the game. But in that moment, I don't think either me or him believe that. But, you know, to be like, okay, so there's half of the dog there. Do you see another half a gray dog on any of the other pieces? You know, and certainly not to patronize your athletes or anyone else who's trying to deal with these things, but to build that muscle of, How are we looking at this? How are we reframing it? It is a skill in itself. And like you say, in those other crunch moments, there's often no one else there to guide you. And if you haven't built that muscle, it can be kind of terrifying, right?
And this is why the stay me part of that triangle that I spoke about before is really important. So how we're actually planning for you to be able to deal with those different levels of performance or an event. So like I often think about it when it used to do more of my clinical site work, if I was treating someone who had arachnophobia or a fear of spiders, yes, you're giving them some skills, but we also need to be able to get them to draw a spider. And even sometimes that can be really hard. Then there's a toy spider in the corner of the room that brings up the arousal rates. Then we bring it until we actually bring a real spider into the room. We can do the same thing with athletes and performers if we understand what their fears are. So if their fear is making mistakes in a grand final, something like that, or where along the way have we brought in some intentional failing sessions, or where have we started to bring in the opportunity for them to be able to make mistakes, where they're so emotionally wired that they're going to make mistakes and test out some of the skills that they have. And we can do some of that in our everyday lives as well. You know, if you've got a fear of spiders, or for me, a fear of heights, which yes, my brother-in-law bought me a jump off the sky tower one time, but that's called flooding. That's not called slowly desensitizing you to what you fear. But yeah, those are real fears, right? But the fear of making mistakes, the fear of success sometimes in New Zealand, the fear of being compared to others, we can start to build that into their training.
You do done a little in a bit safe of exposure and therapy.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah, exactly.
When you've got people who, I mean, I wonder if there's like a slight, almost like a slight bias when you're working with so many very successful people, right? You must see a lot of people who are very driven to succeed and are really doing everything they can to pull every lever to hit the top. Do you think there's any differences in how people who are really focused on performing and really focused on delivering make sure they are people who perform and deliver versus people who maybe struggle to hit those metrics that they might want for themselves, but they just don't hit them for whatever reason? Are there certain ways of looking at the world or certain ways of moving through the world that differentiate people on those lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference between some of those people is that the people who are high performers and getting what they want, they will always find ways to do extras. They're always really curious, significantly more curious in the way that they're performing. They're searching for more a lot of the time, and they're not using excuses. And I come back to that bottom part of the triangle where it's about understand who I am. When they're more secure in who they are, they're much more likely to delve into some of those areas. Whereas someone that's a lot more insecure in who they are or isn't prepared to fail or is overly perfectionistic isn't likely to really push themselves to the limits that they really want to go to. What I tend to find is that there's three types of behaviors that people do who are underperforming. And one of those is they will shift responsibility. So they will blame other people. They'll blame conditions of the pitch. They'll blame referees. They'll find other things rather than looking at the mirror and themselves. They'll overcompensate. So sometimes that can even look like over-preparing at times. And that's just to kind of manage their own anxiety, rather than actually just kind of letting things flow a little bit more. And the other one is the succumb. So SOS stands for essentially, so raising the white flag. So succumb is basically giving up on things, but that's often because they haven't tied things to their values. They're not really clear on where they're going and how they're going to get there. They don't have the support system around them because they believe they can do it on their own. Whereas what we find with the athletes that or high performers, there's three behaviors that we'll see them typically do. The first one is they adapt. So they're much faster to adapt to a certain situation. And that partly comes from being curious. C, courage. M, much more likely to show courage in particular situations. Acknowledge that there's some sort of fear, anxiety there, be okay with that. But then they'll shift into actually what does courageous action look like in the next step. And the last one, T, is trust. So they're trusting in themselves. They're trusting in their support system around them. They're okay with people having them, having helped them in those particular moments as well. So those are probably, I think, about three different behaviors that I would notice between those people who are really succeeding and the ones that I wouldn't say are not succeeding, but are still really struggling to find their way, we see more likelihood in those two different three different behaviors.
I think what you've said there, that's something that's really stuck for me is, you know, when you're talking about, you know, not shifting responsibility. And this really, forgive me, this is going to be somewhat of a crude quote. It's not me, it's Max Verstappen. but I love watching Formula One. Mm-hmm. We don't have TV on it with breakfast at our house unless there's been a race overnight and then the race highlights are on. It's like happening.
Us with football. If there's football on and if Manchester United are playing in the morning, it's probably going to be on the TV in the morning.
Some things we just have to break the rules for.
This is okay.
Yeah. There are rules and then there are times to break those rules.
Yeah.
So Max Verstappen, I love his press moments because he just says whatever the hell he wants. And he got asked something from a reporter along the lines of, oh, well, if this would have happened, would your result have been better? And he just turned around and was like, if my mother had a penis, she'd be my father.
Mm. Yeah.
For starters, what an amazing quote. Secondly, true. Like, well, debatable, but true in terms of what he's trying to say. There's something that I have been trying to implement in my own life, and it has genuinely changed my life, of radical self-responsibility in terms of, and this could get misconstrued, so I need to make sure I say the full thing, because I take myself as being responsible for everything, even the things that aren't my fault. And by that, I don't mean pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I don't mean we're all islands and if you're not getting ahead, it's because you suck and you haven't worked hard enough. It's more that nobody's coming to save me. And if something happens to me, it may well not be my fault, but I still have to deal with it. What am I going to do? What can I control? As you mentioned earlier. And that might be, I can go and seek help from this person. You know, I'm still part of a community. There have been so many people that have helped me along the way at various times. But it's still on me to go and seek that help and to figure out what's next. And that mindset frame, I came across that, I don't know, 2, maybe 3 years ago, totally changed the way I approach the world and has paid off probably more than anything else I've changed in my life before. And I really think it is this thing of you can acknowledge that the world can be hard sometimes. Definitely things get thrown our way that are not fair. We've still got to deal with it, right? And that must be quite hard with athletes. I mean, I imagine you run into an injury or something. It'd be very easy to fall into a self-pity spiral, but you've got to figure out what's next, right?
Yeah. But I think there's an element of self-compassion in that. Sometimes my job is to change, you know, negative performance inhibiting thoughts into what people would say positive thoughts. But like if I keep on going down the positive track, then that just puts people in a bullshit world. And I don't think that that's okay. That's unrealistic. I like the concept just of optimism. So, you know, negativity is glasses half empty. Positivity is glasses half full. Optimism is there's water in the glass and I'm just going to drink the thing, right? So I think like if there's an injury or something like that, it's okay to wallow in it for a little bit. Like let your emotions like take over. That's really important. That's part of being a human being. But there comes a point in time where, as you were saying, we do need to shift. But I don't want that to take away from the experience of feeling the emotion, whether it be shame, embarrassment, sadness, anxiety. That's okay, because it's our brain and our body telling us something that is really important. Sometimes that we actually genuinely really care about what's going on for me. But then there comes a time where we actually need to shift. And really, like my job when working with someone is to help them understand, well, when is that time? And normally that question comes around, well, is this serving you? What is helpful in this moment? Is it unhelpful for you? What's it stopping you doing? Who's it impacting? Who's it affecting? And that will help then create that change. Yeah. So like, I totally understand what you're saying. And then taking that accountability and that responsibility. And I see it all the time. Typically high performance, they're pretty good at doing that. In fact, I'd sometimes say they take too much responsibility, and we could learn a little bit more from how do we self-compassionate in those moments. Because I think even, we talk about resilience, for example. A lot of people think that resilience is being hard and it's being tough. And in those moments on the field, when you make a mistake, most athletes will be critical of themselves in that particular moment because that has worked for them. That is what has got them to this high performance. But in that moment, if you stay critical on yourself, you can stay in a loop of being a bit of a victim. And we don't want them to do that in a fast-paced match. So Kristen Neff, who's an amazing researcher around self-compassion research and resilience, she's shown that people who are more self-compassionate with themselves are more resilient as well. And so what we're wanting them to do is speak really kindly to themselves in that particular moment. So I think when we have some of these setbacks, it's kind of saying, well, what is important for me right now? Is it probably talking to myself in a kind way so that I actually can shift and I can move on? Or do I want to spend more time in this victim stance for too long? And what does that look like and who does it impact?
You have perfectly led into something I really want to talk to you about, because I think there's always, if you're reaching for something, there's risk, whether that's sport or finance. And you take enough risks, even if you've done your homework, even if you've put the work in, at some point, a risk isn't going to work out. That's how risk works. So when someone has hit that moment where it hasn't paid off, and you could sit in this moment of, we've failed, and particularly high-performing people could be so critical on themselves, how do you go from we've failed to what's next? Is it taking that moment of, you get a moment, you can marinate, now we go?
I talk about a concept called ACT. So ACT, A is accept and acknowledge, or acknowledge and accept. So acknowledge the feeling that's going on for you at that point in time. There's no point in sweeping it under the rug or trying to push it to the side, because it's going to come up and it will bubble up at some point in time. I'll use another food analogy. How about that? So it's kind of like, especially when you're a teenager and you want something out of the fridge, and you go to open the fridge and there's some rotting food in there, or there's something that's been in there a little bit too long than what it should have. What do most people do, teenagers do? They just shut the door again, right? And then, but eventually you got to eat. So then you open the refrigerator door again, and what happens to the smell? It's worse. It starts wafting through the house, and sometimes we shut it again. The same thing with emotions. You can't just keep shutting them and hope that they will go away, because they will pop up at another time and they'll come up stronger and harder. So the importance of acknowledging what is going on for me and learning ways to be able to accept that this is a part of my human response. So that's A. C is calm. So calm your mind through like breath work, visualization, reframing the situation, going for a walk, doing some exercise, whatever that is. So C is about calm, and T is towards, and I often say towards with courage. So moving towards where I need to go to, what's helpful in this particular situation. Where does that align with my values as a human being? So if it's courage, then what does courage look like in the next 5 minutes, or across the next 5 days, or across the next 5 weeks? If it's to do with integrity, what does that look like? And start to label a couple of behaviors that you can start to attach yourself to, and then start to deliver on those particular behaviors. But again, it has to be aligned with your values if you want to start to shift.
To take the step back and say, from your years of working with people and helping them achieve goals, if there was one thing that you thought almost everyone could benefit from to achieve more of their goals, to boost their performance, what would that thing be?
The first one that I would say, in order to boost performance, attention is the most important thing. Where you place your attention and having control over that is really important. So there was some research done around golfers and shooters, between the ones that were elite and the ones that weren't so elite. And what they noticed, and just before they took their shot, the elite golfers were able to hold their attention for that little bit longer in terms of their gaze with their eyes. So they were able to hold that just for that little second longer, despite their heart rate still going at the exact same rate. They were able to do that, and that was a big benefit in terms of them executing their performance. And so we know from attention, from mindfulness as well, from this guy, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who originally started in the 70s, looking at the relationship between how we think and pain. And he realized that putting your attention and using mindfulness in the places that you want it to can change your relationship with pain. Very fascinating. And so I would say the number one skill that you can learn is about where you place your attention and how you train that. And you can do that through mindfulness. You can do that simply through sipping your favorite wine at night and really paying attention to the flavors and the taste. You can do it when you're washing the dishes, if people still wash the dishes. Or just even noticing, for example, like the different textures of like the soap suds and the different noises that it makes when you get in the shower, for example, when you're noticing the differences between the temperatures on your back versus on your chest, or what the soap suds smell like. You're using all your senses to train your attention to the present moment. because there is so much noise going on in the world that our minds get cluttered, emotion takes over. And if we can bring ourselves back to the present moment, that is the number one skill. If I was going to say anything else, it would come back to understanding, being curious about who you are as a human being, regardless of what your performance looks like, regardless of whether you're a CE, whether you're a high performance athlete, mum, dad, whatever that kind of looks like. It's just really try to be curious about who you are as a human being and what pulls you away from being you, but also what brings you into being you.
Is there ever anything that people don't ask you about or don't expect you to have thoughts on that you wish they did ask you about because you think it's important and you want to give them a little tip in that area?
Gnarly one, but I think something around perfectionism. And I often think there's no such thing as a perfectionist. There's only such things as imperfectionists, because only perfectionists look at their imperfection. And I think I'm trying to learn myself, or trying to also help people, what does actually good enough look like opposed to being perfect? How do you kind of marry up, you know, your actual self with your performative self? So a psychologist that I see, is always talking to me about, you're always in performance mode. There's always some sort of achievement. There's always what's next, what's better. And how do you just learn to be okay with being you? How do you stop from trying to prove yourself? And what does that start to look like? And it's often the perfectionist loops that start to get me caught up. And I think that's something that a lot of us could start to work on, is simply understanding where perfection takes us to a place that we don't want to be, even though it serves us in certain realms. But what does good enough look like? Because a lot of the time when we're struggling with something, either emotionally or a situation, I tend to find one of the most common core beliefs is, I am not good enough. And when that gets triggered, that really changes the way that we avoid or we approach a particular situation. Again, whether it's financial or whether it's a sporting event or whether it's a conversation with our kid. And so understanding what good enough actually looks like, and writing that down and being aware of it and paying it more attention and being okay with actually probably being good enough is simply taking your first breath in the morning. And that's okay. Anything else is a bonus. Imagine if we could live our lives like that when I woke up, I breathed, and then anything else is a bonus. We'd be more grateful, significantly more happier, although I don't want us to get caught in a happiness trap, but more satisfied with what we're doing, what we're learning, how we're being curious, how we're showing up and showing courage. I think that would be something that I'm quite interested in, still trying to work out for myself.
I love that. You've given me so much food for thought in this episode, but especially that last bit. Definitely, definitely identify with a lot of what you've had to say there. Thank you so much, John Batiste, clinical and sports psychologist. I mean, you're brilliant. So thank you very much for giving us your insights from working with all these high performing people. Now, if this episode was helpful to you, first of all, hit subscribe to Making Sense wherever you're listening, but also send it to a friend so we can all level up with money or whatever other areas of your life you want to have some high performance in. We can all level up together. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go, this podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.